Did you know that there are over 200 episodes of Outtakes for you to listen to whenever you want and when you want? Head to joy.org.au/outtakes to catch up on our exclusive interviews with amazing filmmakers, incredible actors, and industry powerhouses, including Barry Jenkins, John Waters, Sue Maslin, Sebastian Lelio, Yen Tan, Joel Edgerton, Anna Kokonos, John Cameron Mitchell, Warwick Thornton, Luca Guadagnino, Rose Trochet, and more. On Outtakes, we cover all of the best movie festivals across Australia and explore queer film against a broader cultural, political, and cinematic backdrop. We also like to look at what's winning awards and have an opinion or two on everything from classic to modern cinema and the importance of camp. Check us out at joy.org.au/outtakes and on Spotify and iTunes. Outtakes is the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9.
Do you know how happy I am that we slept together?
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty. I can't stand it anymore.
I'm not a stranger to the dawn. Come on, girls. Let's go shopping.
We procured for him. He used us as bait.
Gonna stomp your little lassies and Prada shoes at me,
honey. Let the storm rage on.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9. Gina, Alan and Daniel taking you through for the next hour. Now, this week on Outtakes, to celebrate the theatrical release of Peter Strickland's In Fabric, we are donning our favourite frocks. We're lacing up, getting on our velvet, our satin, our silk, or in the case of Gina, our denim.
Thank you.
Got you covered, Gina.
But what about you, Daniel, and your leather? You just left that out.
I took a photo.
Oh, we did. Oh, mm-hmm. Good. We have evidence. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Gina. Mm-hmm. Can I see it after the show?
Totally.
We are celebrating with a frivolous kind of joy that you'll only find on this program, Dresses in Queer Cinema. How's that for a niche topic?
Oh, that is so niche.
We'll
make any film queer, you know that. So any dress is up for grabs.
We'll be revisiting our interview this evening with Marion Boyce, who was the costume designer in The Dressmaker, which of course shattered all box office records in 2015 here in Australia. And we'll also be speaking with the cult filmmaker, Peter Strickland. Now, he's the cult filmmaker of many films. We've spotlighted some of them on the program before, but his new film, In Fabric, hits cinemas later this week. It's a kind of surreal and farcical horror that we appreciate Strickland so much for. It weaves a kind of heady spell of high fashion and bloodshed.
I think something's wrong with that dress.
Don't tell me you're scared of a dress.
Ripped it to pieces.
Spanking, spanking you almost.
Such a pretty dress.
Anything nice in the sales?
Just a dress.
Just a taste there of Peter Strickland's In Fabric, which of course has been doing the festival circuit and which hits cinema screens across the country later this week. An interesting film to spotlight on the program. Quite the farce, but we're not above a bit of a farce here on Outtakes, are we?
That's every week, isn't it, Daniel? There's always something farcical.
Yeah. But that's the thing, kind of a murderous dress. How eerie was that trailer? It's how I feel every time somebody asks me why I'm not wearing a dress. Like, it kind of just imbues that kind of dread that I feel as a butch lesbian.
Well, one thing's for sure, Gina, if I did see you in a dress, I would think you were possessed.
Can I tell you a funny story?
That you are wearing this haunted dress.
Complete detour and taking us off topic is when my mother confronted me about being queer when I was 16, one of the things she said is it because you never wore dresses? And I'm like, probably.
It's because I knitted as a child. I was taught to knit. That's why I'm queer too. So look, it's got to be this garment making thing.
Look, I have found a dress. Fabric. If I ever had to wear a dress, because as you know, as denim, as you mentioned, mentioned in the opening, denim is my go-to. But if I ever have to wear a dress, I know I can follow Billy Porter in that tuxedo gown that he wore to the Oscars.
Okay.
Billy Porter from Pose.
But that was in velvet. Velvet and satin, yeah?
Yeah, I could do velvet.
Look good in velvet and satin.
I think I could rock velvet and satin, that kind of tuxedo.
Especially manacles, velvet manacles.
Yes. Anyway, let's get back on track, Daniel.
Billy Porter is not the only one bringing dresses to our attention. Certainly cinema has been doing that for a very long time, and it is full of iconic dresses. This is not the first time we've kind of tackled the topic of iconic dresses in cinema. Alan, that's because this topic is very close to your heart.
Why do you say that?
Bonnets.
Because I like to wear female clothing. Is that it? Is that what you're saying? I have a secret closet.
There's no way of answering that.
I got
that
a photo of that too.
Correct.
No. You know, is this it? I've got no. Yes. What? Are you talking about like period dramas?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh, without a doubt. I mean, and of course, I've got my dresses separated into three stacks.
You
here.
Really do.
I do. And so one stack is sort of historical kind of bonnet and bustle kind of stuff.
Well, we're going to be looking at a few particular films which I think handle the dress in a stylistic but also substantive way. And we're going to unpack how that looks in queer cinema over the course of the program. But perhaps to get us started, Alan, what are some of the most iconic dresses, do you think, in cinema's kind of history?
Well, for me, number one, the first thing that came to my mind when we talked about the topic of this show was Vivien Leigh in Gone with the Wind.
I thought of another Vivien,
That amazing green velvet dress that she makes out of drapes from Tara. You know, this is her going in to conquer the male world to get the money that she needs to create her new business empire. I mean, you know, that is a standout dress.
Whereas the Vivien I was thinking of was Vivien in Pretty Woman.
Oh,
and the dresses
I didn't
in
know
that.
That's what her name was.
Yes, oh. So it's Vivien Leigh. Yes. And one of my favourite lines is when she's in that amazing gown as they're in the lift and she turns to, what's his name?
Richard Gere.
You see, I don't pick up on the men. clear lesbian. is that line where she says, in case I forget to tell you later, I had a really good time tonight. Like, you can remember her in that gown as they're on the way to the opera and how dresses kind of feature in that.
But Pretty Woman's a really interesting example, isn't it? Because, of course, Julia Roberts heads into this dress store to purchase a dress, and because of what she's wearing, she's refused entry.
Yeah.
So here we have the dress as a kind of symbol of the character, and oftentimes that's how dresses are used. So if we look, you know, I'm always always have a ready Disney example at hand, but if we go to a film like Beauty and the Beast, and I don't think animated films are entirely bad examples when we look at dresses in cinema, but if we look at a film like Beauty and the Beast, we have a kind of everyday matronly blue and white dress that she wears at the beginning of the film, and then of course at the end of the film this great yellow ball gown, this gold ball gown, and that the change in the dress symbolizes a kind of change in character, this kind of rags to riches story.
Which is Pretty Woman all over. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, Pretty Woman is a fairy tale, isn't it? So, of course, here we have again.
A prostitute becomes a princess. I mean.
With no sexual health checks amongst any part of that film, but anyway.
Well, is it?
The prince,
different time,
the prince,
Gina,
and the
pauper, different
the prostitute and the prince. There you go.
But really, the dress is the thumbprint to not only a period in history, a kind of socioeconomic status, but really the character. Dresses tell us so much about these characters.
I mean, it's the same with Cinderella as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, when you think about it, you know, the fairy godmother comes in and turns her into another princess. So
into a lady.
Well. Cinderella's really the epitome of...
patriarchy, sorry.
That no, kind go. Of rags.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
It is a symbol of the patriarchy. Yes, and we've unpacked it so many times.
Well, I was thinking about that today. Of course, Cinderella, certainly Disney's animated 1950s version, is a really interesting look at dresses.
Sorry, I just picked up on... You were thinking about that today. Of course you were. Disney's always sitting in the back.
It is, isn't it?
Sorry.
Disney's not at the back of his mind. It's at the forefront of his
mind.
Did
anyone else wake up this morning and go,
seriously,
Disney?
There is a Cinderella. Whole portion of Daniel's brain devoted to Disney.
You know what? I'm going to move us along. We had Marion Boyce. She is the costume designer behind many great films, including, of course, the record-breaking Dressmaker on our program in 2015. Can you believe it was that long ago?
I can't believe it's 5 years ago and that younger Hemsworth brother is 5 years older. Damn.
He looks the same, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah, it's remarkable.
Now, we had her on the program and we put to her some of our favourite dresses from cinema history, and we asked her to pick from those examples what her favourite cinematic dress was. Here's what Marion had to say.
Now, we do want to ask you as well about, you know, some of the best costumes in other films. And to do this, we thought we'd have a little award ceremony. So cue the music. Can't resist a bit of show music. But we are going to have the Outtakes Awards for Best Costume Design. And Marion, you have agreed to be our arbiter. You've agreed to pick the best film. So we've put together a list of nominees, and you get to decide.
Oh.
No pressure whatsoever.
Thank you.
So our first award is for most memorable dress in a film. And the nominees are Grace Kelly to Catch a Thief, Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz, Marilyn Monroe for The 7-Year Itch, Vivien Leigh in Gone with the Wind, specifically the curtain dress, Audrey Hepburn in Breakfast at Tiffany's, and Keira Knightley in Atonement, the green dress, the famous green dress.
Before you pick a winner, how do you feel about our nominations? Have we got it right?
Have we got a good selection?
It's eclectic. Look, there's some fantastic frocks there. Mm-hmm. There's some, personally, I wouldn't have chosen, but that's
really? I would love to hear.
I'm not going there.
Oh, no. Okay. Rightio.
Look, I think The Wizard of Oz is pretty fantastic. Look, there's a lot of frocks, and lots of them for different reasons, but there's a few there that are really character-driven. The Marilyn Monroe 7-Year Itch perfectly summed up that character.
Yes.
So did The Wizard of Oz. The Keira Knightley dress frock was an amazing frock, but I'm not sure that it advanced the plot like a few others.
Yes.
Mm. Okay. That's interesting commentary.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Interesting commentary, says you, Alan.
Yes, that's just me, because I had nothing else to say. I didn't know how to respond to that.
Are you
going to
question?
Well, I mean,
that authority?
It's a fair point. She does say that the dress from the 7-Year Itch sort of personifies the character and advances the plot. And so too does Dorothy's dress in The Wizard of Oz. I mean, without a doubt. I mean, going from black and white to colour.
But also the Dorothy dress is very similar to, say, the Alice dress in Alice in Wonderland, or the Belle dress in Beauty and the Beast, I mean, or the Wendy dress in, of course, I'm resorting to Disney examples.
In Peter Pan.
But the point is, you know, it says something about this kind of homely, maidenly character.
Well, I would say, you know, chaste and virginal.
Correct.
That's it, isn't it?
On the cusp of womanhood.
Oh, on the cusp of womanhood. You know, that phrase has got such imagery in my mind, Daniel. Let's not go there.
But the dressmaker is, you know, when we think about, you know, dresses as a character, dresses as a shield, dresses as kind of a visual narrative in film, I mean, it is the epitome of that. I mean, when Tilly arrives in the town, is it Hugo Weaving, I think, is one of the first people that she sees, and you know, he's this police officer who I think he questions her, is that Dior? We think she's about to be arrested, but no, he's more interested in what she's wearing. But it's to look at the dressmaker again, and even looking at Australian films and the way dresses are used as costume, the dressmaker again, you know, the first tones that we see the characters in the town, they're dreary, they're drab, they kind of bleed into the background, and it's almost like the film Pleasantville, where it becomes colour. The minute Tilly arrives, the minute the fabric arrives, even the way her mother comes to life when that fabric and that colour and those dresses come out and reform people, they become shields and characters in themselves. The dressmaker of course it should be, you know, based on its title. It is one of, you know, it is an iconic, gorgeous Australian film, but the epitome of how a dress can be more than just that fairy tale at the end of Cinderella. It is a character in itself.
Well, it's almost another type of rags to riches journey, isn't it? And it's interesting how costume and indeed dresses are so important to the telling of that story on our big screens. Mm. We are, of course, looking this evening at films that spotlight dresses in cinema, a kind of frivolous end to the public holiday. but coming up after this, we are
should be a frockulous end to the public holiday.
Nice.
Do you like that? I tried.
Not your best effort, but we'll pay it.
Another 50 minutes.
Later in the program, of course, we're speaking to Peter Strickland. He's the cult filmmaker behind the new film In Fabric, which releases later this week. And, of course, more with Marion Boyce, the costume designer of The Dressmaker, as well as some reviews of really important new, fresh queer films to tackle the dress as a motif in cinema. More coming up on Outtakes right after this.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening, to celebrate the theatrical release of Peter Strickland's In Fabric, we are looking at our favourite dresses in queer cinema. We are joined by Peter Strickland later on the program, but we have been looking at The Dressmaker because that is a really interesting example of how dresses can be used in cinema, both stylistically but also as plot devices too.
And it was, I mean, we can easily sing the praises of The Dressmaker, but we started kind of coming down with a list, and we started recognising a pattern in Australian film, and especially Australian film with, you know, maybe a central or leading female protagonist, or even just any female protagonist, but that dresses seem to be really pivotal in the telling of the story. I mean, the first one we all thought about was Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, but then we started kind of looking at other Australian films. I mean, yes, there's Ladies in Black, but Muriel's wedding and the way that wedding dress and her repeatedly choosing, you know, going across all of Sydney, finding a dress to kind of almost find herself and find her truth. Like, it's
this idea that clothes maketh the man, isn't it? And certainly that's, for Muriel, the dress, the wedding dress, it kind of encapsulates this vision, this dream of how her life can be. Mm. And we see that. We've looked at Pretty Woman. I mean, we see that in Pretty Woman as well. We see that in films like even Breakfast at Tiffany, that opening shot. That dress symbolizes so much about the character. It's this idea that the dress maketh the woman.
And even Titanic, again, Kate Winslet, who we see in The Dressmaker, the way dresses are kind of used in Titanic. And, it, you know, the dress, that gown that she kind of ends up, you know, getting very wet at the end of the film, spoiler, is kind of an act of rebellion in the way that she then uses and then embodies that dress in that dancing scene.
Yes.
How, you know, people will perceive her as one way because of the dress, but then she kind of breaks.
The dress can be reused,
correct.
Repurposed.
Yeah.
Breaks her bond, so to speak.
Yeah.
Now, we did look at The Dressmaker in a bit more depth when it hit cinemas almost 5 years ago. Can you believe it's been that long? It shattered records. We had Sue Maslin, the producer of the film, on the program. We've had her on the program a few times now. But we were also joined by the costume designer in The Dressmaker, such an important part of that film, the costume. Marion Boyce, she joined us on the program. Here's a throwback to not only The Dressmaker, but part of our interview with Marion Boyce.
I need to remember the truth.
They say that she killed a boy.
So where did you go from here?
I worked in London, Milan, and Paris.
I reckon you came home for one of two things, revenge or me.
Gertrude Pratt. The dance is Saturday night.
A dress can't change anything.
Watch and learn, Gertrude. Watch and learn. I can make you the most striking girl in the room. Take your clothes off.
A murderer and a lesbian.
Stunning.
You can transform people.
Use it.
Kelly Dunwich.
I remember that day.
She saw the whole thing.
She murdered him.
She's cursed.
I didn't do it. It's just a pack of lies.
They'll never forgive me for that boy's death.
You're wasted here.
Stop it, Charger!
With what? Sitting?
Why didn't you tell me?
You don't scare me, Tilly Dunnage. Tilly Dunnage, you've enriched my life. I reckon you can make some bloke pretty happy.
You could be married in this suit, snapped up by some eligible spinster or hag.
Costumes played an absolute pivotal role in The Dressmaker. I mean, that's the actual reason for the being of that film. Wouldn't you agree, Marion?
Yes. I mean, the book was called The Dressmaker, so it was sort of a bit of an interesting gig. It sort of made you hyperventilate for a minute when you first began.
Because you were so excited of the possibilities? Is that why you're hyperventilating?
Well, a few reasons, actually. One was because it's called The Dressmaker, so he went, wow, okay, this is like a main focus point. It's not just about character. It's actually a large part of the story. So it was a really nice, it's a really lovely period to explore. There was a lot of excitement about that period. Mm. And to bring that to life in Australia with the contrast of the Australian landscape, it was great.
Where did you draw your palette from? Because did you try and mirror the Australian landscape, or did you try and juxtapose the landscape?
The film's made up of, there's many, many different journeys within The Dressmaker.
Yes.
So the early 1950s in Australia was in a very dusty country town, and we did a Drysdale palette. So that was very sort of drenched of okay. colour. Mm-hmm. A lot of country towns at the time really had an enormous amount of 40s clothing. Mm. It wasn't up to date.
Because it's still post-war and we're still in austerity, still in rationing. Yes.
And an enormous amount of poverty.
Yes.
Within country towns. Mm. So there was... So when Tilly came to town, the excitement of the colour and the movement and the crispness of the cloth was just, to them, was just... It was like an alien landing on Earth.
And I think that comes across very clearly in the film.
Yes, doesn't it?
And Hugo Weaving's character was just ecstatic.
Oh, he was delicious. He was totally delicious. A great character, and Hugo played the part really beautifully. He nearly moved me to tears at one part in the film. He was touching a piece of cloth, and you could see the tears in his eyes. And he has the understanding of what cloth can actually do, and it really, I was quite touched by it.
I think there's a scene in the film where he is handling cloth. Mm. He says that he has to open up this tea chest as a matter of urgency, and you see him going into ecstasy. Mm. It's orgasmic when he's going from material to material, in particular the sequins. I think he was most excited about the touch of the sequins. So you have a portrait of what this character is about, or what purpose this character serves in the film, and you design according to that?
You have to work out the characters. Every part of costume design is actually understanding the character and bringing that character to life. It's part of the actor's performance. Mm-hmm. And it informs you how the different sorts of fabrics move in very, very different ways. So mm-hmm. that helps the actor with their movement, with their gait, with mm-hmm. the way they sit, if they need to hide within their clothes or they need to fly.
Do you have consultations with the actors about, you know, what they think the character should wear, what you think they should wear?
It's in conjunction with the director and the producer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So your job is, when you get the script, is that you need to break it down. You have to make a series of decisions and find the backstories. And mm-hmm. you've got to find out what makes a character tick.
Right.
And then you have many conversations, and you also with the art department, with the production designer, you see the house and the way that he's dressing the house and the choices that he's making, the cars they drive, all sorts of parts of that will be add to the character.
So it's a very much a collaborative process.
Filmmaking is very collaborative.
Just part of our chat with costume designer Marion Boyce. She, of course, designed the costumes for The Dressmaker, which is a really great example of the way dresses are used in cinema, both as a thumbprint to a character, but also as a kind of plot device, really.
Yeah. And a whole other character altogether.
I remember, Alan, the evening we had Marion in the studio, you were swanning around the studio pretending that you were wearing the swan dress from that film.
The swan dress?
Sarah Snook's dress. Do you remember that?
Well, I think I was probably more in the headspace of the shoes because, you know, I love a stiletto, as you know.
We haven't done a program on shoes yet.
No,
maybe
we
that's
haven't.
An upcoming program.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And we'll all have to wear our best Manolos.
I don't know what a Manolo is.
Manolo Blahnik.
Oh, my goodness, Daniel. What kind of gay are you? Can yeah, back your
or Jimmy Choo's. Come on,
God,
Jimmy
even
Choo's,
I as a Manolo. Butch lesbian. Oh, well, Lord. I think it's Sex in the City, goodness. Honey. I think that's what taught us.
Hand over your gay card, please,
yeah,
Daniel.
Yeah, I know.
Where we are stamping demerit points. 10 points for Gryffindor for you.
I love that you just assume I'm in Gryffindor. I'm so okay with that. We are
either that or Slytherin.
Yeah.
No, definitely. He's a Gryffindor.
He's a Hufflepuff.
Actually, he's probably more of a Ravenclaw, actually.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Can we move on,
okay,
please?
Definitely a Ravenclaw. Yeah.
We are celebrating not Hogwarts houses, but dresses in queer cinema this evening. Of
costume.
Course, we've been looking back at The Dressmaker, but coming up next, we're going to look at a new French film, which is screening at both the Alliance French Film Festival here in Melbourne, and also, of course, Melbourne Queer Film Festival. So two different festivals that you can catch this film at. The film is The Two of Us, and we'll be spotlighting it right after this. You're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening it's all about cinematic dresses. We are celebrating the theatrical release of Peter Strickland's In Fabric, which hits cinemas next week, by looking at our favourite cinematic dresses. Not just favourite because they look good or they're a thumbprint to a character, but also, as in the case of this next film, they're used as really interesting plot devices.
Well, not many lesbian films feature dresses.
well, certainly not as a imagine. Focal point.
No, look, maybe...
Maybe Carol?
Maybe Carol? Actually Carol, but that's
actually,
not...
Carol was nominated for Best Costume Design.
Mm.
But lost, I don't... But you know, we don't see... We don't look at Carol and go, oh, you know, that
the
dress.
Dresses.
The dresses. Yeah. And we don't think of them as kind of character pieces. But, you know, The Two of Us, it was funny, we were watching it the other night because it is featuring in both MQFF and the French Film Festival. And there is a gorgeous little small plot device of a red dress that we see in the setup of the film that kind of shows the relationship, and it's used again during the climax of the film as kind of I would call it a kind of an armor that one of the characters wears. So it is, you know, when you were kind of saying dresses, and I'm like, well, here's an opportunity to talk about a really gorgeous film that audiences should go and see at either of the two festivals.
So the film is The Two of Us.
The Two of Us. Now, it is basically, we always talk about representation of older people on screen. This is exactly that. It is the story of two retired women, Nina and Madeline, who are carrying quite a big secret. They live in the same apartment building. They've got apartments opposite each other, but they're actually their long-term partners who just haven't kind of come out to the rest of the world. They're a community or their own, well, one of the characters' children.
Yep.
So it is the story of this secret that they're hoping to escape from by moving to Rome and living a bit more authentically, but then something happens to one of the characters, which then puts a really big dramatic bridge between the relationship of the two.
It's heartbreaking, really.
It is.
You know, we've got these, you know, the I guess what's really the point in the matter here, Gina, is the relationship that Madeline has with her children. She hasn't told her children.
She hasn't.
And her daughter has got this beautiful 10-year-old grandson.
Boy. Yeah.
And, you know, she obviously loves her family so much that, you know, she's worried about hurting them, and she obviously doesn't want to leave them.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this is where all of the dramatic kind of tension comes from, really, is as you say, the secret with that Maddo has kept from her children. And when she suffers a stroke,
yeah,
that almost brings an end to the relationship between Evelyn and Madeline altogether.
And it's, you know, we know we have a lot of coming out stories, you know, in our kind of canon of films, but this is kind of, we see her, you know, we see someone in her probably 60s or 70s, would you say, late 60s?
Oh, goodness, late 60s for late sure, early 60s. Yeah, late
early
60s,
70s,
yeah.
Who is still needing to come out to her children, and we see the anxiety built around that, and we see the impact of her not being able to be authentic and what the fallout of that is, not only for her partner who, you know, it's, look, it is, there is heartbreak to this film, but don't go in there thinking you're going to see another dead lesbian on screen. So, you know, this is a really emotive, captivating film. It leaves you with hope. It leaves you, I don't know, it's a really kind of...
I think it does, but I think what the film also talks about really is that loss of agency that an older person can have when they suffer a stroke or a heart attack. You know, they're virtually at the mercy of carers and of their
children. If they have children
and,
as well.
You know, so loss of agency, loss of autonomy, and this is what we
and
see.
Wealth.
This is what we see here. We see Evelyn completely locked out of that relationship.
When I came in the studio, I haven't seen this film, Gina, but you said to me there was something really interesting about the way that this red dress was used as a kind of bookend in the film. What is it that was that made the use of that motif so interesting?
Look, because, you know, there very early on we find out that the character has had a stroke and it's all about getting memory back. So the dress is used as a kind of symbol, and I can't tell you too much about how it plays out in the climax of the film because that would be giving the whole bloody film away, Daniel. But there is a, you know,
so
music.
Just ask Alan, he loves doing that.
But that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I know, I'm seeing it. Trying to keep it
I want people to see this film because I think it's a really important film. But it does, you know, it not only is the dress, and it's a very small plot device, but music in the way of kind of bringing the character back and finding that truth. Look, it is showing at MQFF Film Festival. There's two screenings, one on the 15th of March, one on the 21st of March. But if you can't make those dates, the French Film Festival is also featuring this, like so many screenings at the French Film Festival.
Where do people head? I know we've spotlit MQFF on the program before, but for information about the French Film Festival?
Literally, the website is afrenchfilmfestival.org.
Well, that just makes sense, doesn't
easy.
It?
Easy. Because it's such a big festival and it's all around Australia, but, you know, find Melbourne and then you'll literally, there's more than 10 screenings. And that's, like, this is a beautiful French film and I think it's going to get a beautiful broad audience going to see a film that we would just assume only a queer audience would see. I'm really excited at how the French Film Festival is actually covering this film.
Do you think it might be sort of along the same lines as a Portrait of a Lady on Fire?
No, that I think it's going to have a broader audience.
A broader, even than that. Oh, that's a big call, Gina. Let's wait and see.
Let's hope.
We are celebrating cinematic dresses on Outtakes this evening. Clearly a number of different ways that dresses are utilised by filmmakers to tell their stories. One film that really proves that point is In Fabric, which is the new film by cult filmmaker, director Peter Strickland. Now we are speaking with Strickland right after this. You're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where all evening tonight we have been celebrating the theatrical release of Peter Strickland's In Fabric by looking at some of the most iconic dresses in cinema history and the way that those dresses are used in the course of telling a story. Quick pop quiz. Alan, favourite cinematic dress of all time?
My Fair Lady, My Fair Lady, Audrey Hepburn, My Fair Lady, Ascot.
Gina.
At the races.
Anything Anne Hathaway wears in Devil Wears Prada.
Oh, come on, Gina.
But that's not dresses. You're asking this little butch here to pick a favourite dress. Yeah, no, that ain't going to happen.
Well, I don't think she wears a dress in there, does she?
She does wear a few gorgeous little numbers.
All right, then. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you can have that. You can pass.
Is this gorgeous montage where she crosses over?
I'm handing back your gay card.
I never lost it. Daniel over here.
No, I'm stamping it.
Mm-hmm. No. Double points.
Daniel, favourite dress in all of cinematic history.
Yes, Daniel. Is it a Disney?
No, I'm going to play it safe and say Dorothy Judy Garland in Wizard of Oz. I think that is one of the most iconic dresses. And iconic not just because it's a fashion statement, but iconic because we learn so much about her character just through the dress.
I thought you were going to go Titanic.
I do like the reveal dress, you know, the dress she wears when we first meet her as Kate Winslet's Rose. But
when she gets out of the car.
Correct.
In that kind of tuxedo-styled...
Billy Porter. Oh,
you know, that kind of... it's kind of androgynous, kind of...
I wouldn't put it that high, but sure.
Well, she's dressed in a masculine fashion with a tie.
Now, none of the dresses that we've just touched on are anything like the dress at the heart of Peter Strickland's new film In Fabric. Now, of course, we know Peter Strickland from a number of really iconic cult films. I think he rose to fame with Barbarian Sound Studio. And, of course, we've spotlit the Duke of Burgundy on this program before. That was in 2016. Can you believe it? That film was so long ago.
That must have been in our early single digits, Daniel. Because we're well past our 200th episode now.
We're well past our 200th episode on Outtakes. You can, of course, catch that interview with Peter Strickland on our podcast page, joy.org.au/outtakes. Of course, our interview with Marion Boyce, which we've revisited tonight, also available at that page. But this evening we're speaking with Peter Strickland again about his new film, In Fabric. Now, In Fabric tells the story of Sheila, who is a lonely divorcee who walks into a mysterious department store in London in search of a new dress for a date. Now, she's helped by a saleswoman, Ms. Luckmore, who turns out to be a little bit more than just a saleswoman.
Is that Luckmore?
Luckmore.
Oh, really? She's probably Miss Luckless, by the sounds of it, really.
Now, with the help of Miss Luckmore, or...
Luckless.
Thank you. Sheila encounters the perfect dress. So it's blood red, it's flattering, but unfortunately for Sheila, it is imbued with malevolent powers, which threatens everyone who comes across it. Now, the film...
You said it. You said it, not me. You said comes across it. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Alan! We're going to put him through some training later, I think.
Okay, radio. I'm going to have to go back and go back to school.
Yeah.
The film blends nightmare with fashion and seduction. It's a dark comedy and it's in theatres later this week. Here's part of our chat with Peter Strickland, the director of this fascinating and farcical new film.
I think something's wrong with that dress.
Don't tell me you're scared of a dress.
The dog ripped it to pieces.
Spanking you almost.
Such a pretty dress.
One of the things I loved the most about this film was the kind of cautionary tale that it tells against consumerism. I think that's one of the key themes and strands in this film. I mean, are you trying to say something here about... I mean, obviously the film's set about 30 years ago, but are you trying to say something about consumerism today?
I guess a playful, satirical element to it. I mean, in a weird way, I'm kind of lamenting the loss of bricks and mortar shops. Maybe the... It's not the film to do that, you know, because it's such a demonic shop. I guess I wanted this kind of pantomime villain kind of character behind the till. I think when I wrote the first draft, it was much more anti-consumerist. And then I just felt a bit, I don't know, I just don't like, for me, as a filmmaker, I don't like moralizing or lecturing people. And also, I just feel like a hypocrite because, you know, I'm a consumerist as well. So I try to kind of spend a lot of time with each character to hopefully make the audience relate to them and to feel they would do the same thing. You know, why wouldn't someone who's out of a divorce, her son's girlfriend is horrible to her, her bosses are horrible to her. I think it's quite a valid human experience to stand in a changing room and somehow escape your problems in life. Yeah, I think you have this riot at the end and all the queuing. So I think there is that backdrop. But for me, I think the three main characters are pretty, hopefully, are people you relate to. I mean, they're flawed, of course, but, you know, I had to like the three main people, really. That was like an impetus for starting the film. That I wanted to feel, I don't want them to die, really.
No, well, there is something quite relatable about all of the characters, and I think what the kind of common denominators there, certainly for the if we call them protagonists, certainly for the main characters, is the kind of they're kind of mired in this very dull domesticity that I think we can all relate to, and I think the film is also saying something about domesticity and about how trite the day to day can be, and how we search for fulfillment in places that perhaps aren't in entirely valid.
This film was set in 1993, and in the 90s, certainly, I think for most of my, I'm a sort of typical middle class Brit, but I think for most of my sort of peers, our life was, having these kind of white collar jobs in town, in offices mostly. And then it was escapism on your lunch break. It was going usually to, record shops. but I remember the euphoria and the thrill of, I hate to say it, but just being unshackled from this boredom and buying something that can kind of illuminate your life somehow. Sometimes I wonder, should I have made the film about a haunted piece of vinyl? on the turntable, I tried to sort of a big influence on the film was The Office, Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant.
Right, okay.
Like that, because it was like catharsis through laughter. It wasn't catharsis through self-pity. Because a lot of us, we kind of felt sorry for ourselves, which in hindsight is a bit silly, it wasn't such a big deal doing those jobs, but I think to use humour felt much more interesting and much more... Somehow you kind of get to the core of these characters and their frustrations if you use humour. But I think there's always a danger when you use humour. Sometimes I've been accused of sneering at people or laughing at people.
But I think what your films do so well is that they straddle such a line between the kind of horror and the humorous, and you balance those two worlds so well. And you do that here with fashion and with address. And on the one hand, there's this... You're looking at the kind of fetishization of fashion, really. And on the other hand, you somehow find the utter horror in fashion as well.
I think what I really was trying to get to was a very visceral response to clothing. So starting with the commodification of desire, of human desire, the first place for that is the old shopping catalogue, with these various models. But then going to more intimate places, going to fetishism, going into darker places such as body dysmorphia. I mean, I was always trying to just think of human responses to clothing and bodily fluids, the taboo around bodily fluids. So of course, you have this menstruating mannequin.
Absolutely.
And we don't know if blood is being used as a dye for the dress and so on. I was fascinated with that. In terms of fashion, it was never high fashion. It was more middle class, aspirational, aspiring to elegance, aspiring to sophistication. So there's this kind of thing, you'd go into a change room and have this kind of fantasy of somehow being invited to, the Swiss embassy to have some canapes or whatever.
The way that you're linking kind of menstruation and blood and all these kind of taboo bodily tropes or images, and you link that to the dress. There is a sense that the fashion or the dress is really a part of the person, and certainly that. I mean, you explore that throughout the film, the way that the dress informs its owners. But it feels like you're saying something here about fashion and how we are our fashion.
Well, I think we are our clothing. Definitely, yeah. I mean, the association of someone in a piece of clothing. You see it in the film where Sheila doesn't even want to wash Gwen's underwear in the same washing machine as her clothes. The fact it's been worn by her is just truly disgusting. Whereas Vince is the other extreme. He'll have his face printed where her backside goes. So really, I think association is everything. It's funny, it's about the bodily fluids thing. I don't think it should be taboo, you know, but it's odd because in America, we had to cut the scene with Fatma's character tasting menstrual blood. We would have had an NC-17. I find really odd because, you know, it's a perfectly normal bodily function, whereas R-rated films have the most horrific suffering inflicted on women, you know. So it's just kind of odd for me that something consensual and playful is being damned with an NC-17.
Well, how do you approach that dilemma?
Well, we had to cut it. I think with America, to give a film an NC-17, you're not doing yourselves any favor.
No.
I'm kind of unrepentant. I don't see what the big deal is. I didn't even try to be that shocking. You know, I think, you know, everyone's having fun in that scene. It might be unusual, but, you know, it is a consensual scene.
That was Peter Strickland talking about his new film In Fabric, which opens theatrically later this week. Peter not really agreeing with everything I put to him, but an interesting chat nonetheless.
Daniel, you know how much we love you, but sometimes, you know, when you say that, we're not surprised that he doesn't always agree with what you had to say.
Because we don't.
Because, this is life. But you know, sometimes we do need to acknowledge your superior knowledge in these areas.
No. So, we're moving on again, Alan. Okay, we've been doing that a fair bit this evening, haven't we? Moving on again. This is the trailer for Peter Strickland's In Fabric.
Purchase on a horizon?
I'm just looking, thank you.
The hesitation in your voice, soon to be an echo in the recesses of the spheres of retail. The dress is your image, onto what you project through an illusion.
I'm just going on a date. I don't normally wear this kind of thing.
Be bold. Your date will compliment you. I would like you to announce the numbers to your telephone.
01632 960 7 and 7 8 and 8 6 and 6 and stop.
As promised.
Thank you.
You look different.
Oh my God, what's that? That looks nasty.
Maybe just the washing powder.
Well, I hope it isn't catchy.
How's it going, Sheila?
Everything's fine.
What happened to your hand?
Washing machine went bananas.
You who wear me will know me.
What's that supposed to mean?
It's just a cheap bit of mystery.
I think something's wrong with that dress.
Don't tell me you're scared of a dress.
The dog ripped it to pieces.
Spanking, spanking you almost.
Such a pretty dress.
Anything nice in the sales?
Just a dress.
Just a dress. Well, that has been our program for this evening, all about just a dress, but so much more than a dress, eh? Clearly, dresses, a thumbprint to a character, a thumbprint to a time, a thumbprint to a plot. I mean, they really are so important in the telling of stories.
Well, particularly in this film, I don't think I've ever seen a film about a haunted dress before. What a clever idea, don't you think?
I mean, looking at the movie poster, it has kind of got that 70s kind of horror-esque feel about it. And it's not a horror dress, but I can think of Carrie. And, you know, when that poster image of Carrie, and it reminds me of that, of her dripping in pig's blood in her prom dress. Like, that's the kind of feel I get from this. But
this isn't a Carrie kind of film. I mean, Carrie is a classic horror, isn't it?
This is dark black comedy.
What what Strickland does so well and why he's garnered this name of kind of cult filmmaker for himself is because he plays with generic conventions in a very kind of European 70s, 80s kind of way. He plays with these conventions, he juxtaposes them, he clashes them, and he gives us a kind of interesting cinema that kind of harks back, as I said, to a kind of 70s, 80s kind of farcical horror genre that as Western audiences in 2020, we're not really used to seeing.
That, look, me and dresses, you know, it's a horror film anyway. So,
look, that is it for another week of Outtakes. We have been looking at the way that dresses figure in cinema this evening.
Can we do denim next, the way denim features in cinema?
I feel like there probably is a program there.
Hell yeah.
And
Brokeback Mountain, straight away, it's all in there.
Thelma and Louise.
Thelma and Louise.
Sounding like denim. A pretty interesting program. And let's face it, if anyone's going to do a denim program, it's us.
It is us and certainly me. I'll be behind the panel that night.
That's it for another week of Outtakes.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.